You're listening to Live Free, Think Free on 90.1 KPFT Houston, your home for uncensored news and underground music since 2011.
Uncensored news and underground music since 2011. Live Free, Think Free, another episode on KPFT Houston and all over the interwebs. Oh, goodness. How are you doing, Derek? I guess he's here.
I'm doing great, man. I'm here. I got my water. I'm chilling. It's good, man. It's a Wednesday evening here, November 2nd.
Get through this stuff for over a decade to bring you news. We appreciate everybody who's joined into the conversation. We've got a lot of stuff to get into tonight. We're going to talk about some GMO mosquitoes. I guess they are GMO mosquitoes. We're going to talk about got some super headlines that everybody's catching, which we really, you know, tried to talk about the main subject. We got some things going on the voting on the ballot for right now. And we don't always talk about the ballots, but I've talked about the bonds before. And I was just telling everybody what all we got going on while you sorted out the little bit of difficulties you're having.
Is it any better?
Yeah, that sounded clear.
Okay, cool. Yeah, man, sorry about that. Yeah, I was just saying today is the Day of the Dead here in Mexico. So we had Mir and I built our first little altar. You know, you build a little altar with these flowers and pictures of loved ones and stuff like that. So it was cool. Just got our – everybody takes off work, so a lot of businesses are closed down and people just gather. It's, you know, 2 days after Halloween. So there's a lot of big celebrations left.
Nice. So I know you had a story that you were interested in getting into.
I wanted to get started with this one. This is, you know, we're going to talk about some Houston news. I know you had some of that, but I just wanted to mention this one because I saw it coming across my screen here, and it seems to be, I don't think this is going to be the only story we see like this. Here, let me just pull it up. So I saw this from Zero Hedge, but really it just unfolded on Twitter. And that's how it is sometimes. So it's titled, "You Murderous Hypocrites. Outrage ensues after the Atlantic magazine suggests amnesty for pandemic authoritarians or COVID authoritarians." So it says, "The Atlantic has come under fire for suggesting that all the terrible pandemic era decisions over lockdown, school closures, masking, and punishing an entire class of people who question the efficacy and wisdom of taking a rushed experimental shot should all be water under the bridge." So Professor Emily Oster, who is a huge lockdown proponent over the last couple of years, she wrote for The Atlantic this article titled, "Let's Declare a Pandemic on Amnesty. We need to forgive one another for what we did and said when we were in the dark about COVID." And then she says, "Well, we need to forgive one another for what we did. Let's acknowledge that we made complicated choices in the face of deep uncertainty and then try to work together to build back and move forward." And, you know, the article, of course, gives their own opinion, which I generally would agree. What they say here is that, well, except we weren't in the dark about COVID. There were numerous sources pointing out the actual science showing, you know, that the mandates weren't doing anything, that the shots were lacking the efficacy we were being told, that COVID wasn't as dangerous as we were being told, that the lockdowns were hurting children. Even on this show, Micah, we talked about this in 2020, 2021, as the studies were first coming out, showing pretty quickly that the lockdowns were going to have these impacts. And this is something she admits in her article. So there's another response from this website, The Daily Skeptic, a man named Michael Sanger, I guess he writes there. He said, quote, "There's a lot wrong here. First, no, you don't get to advocate policies that do extraordinary harm to others against their wishes. Then say, quote, we didn't know any better at the time. Ignorance doesn't work as an excuse when the policies involved abrogating your fellow citizens' rights under an indefinite state of emergency while censoring and canceling those who weren't as ignorant." So, and it's interesting, on this article, they're like, look at the ratio of her tweet, which at the time, you know, there was a couple thousand hearts, you know, on the internet, for those who don't know, a ratio, specifically on Twitter, YouTube, places like that, is when, you know, somebody says something and the ratio of likes to dislikes or to, in this case, hearts versus 28,000 plus comments that are not very happy with her, that's considered a ratio. And I'm going to see if we can pull this up, because this article was, you know, published yesterday, and I actually was looking at this today, and I think it's much much more than that. But I want to go on and get a little deeper, because it's more than just what this woman said. What I think is important is that there are people responding. Let me see if I can pull this up. There's people saying, like, talking about how they had to talk to their loved one, their mother, through a window. There's a guy I saw who posted on the tweet. Let me just see if I can get it pulled up real quick. Posted on the tweet saying that I had to talk to my mother through a window for the last few weeks of her life as she died. She didn't die from COVID. She died from loneliness, is what this person was saying. And I just think that's interesting, right? So, like, you have, here's her tweet. So 2,000 comments, 2,000 hearts, 30,000 comments, and a lot of them are not very happy. If you go into this at on her Twitter account, you can just see people sharing their real world stories and saying, like, you want me to forget how, you know, I was fired from my job. You want me to forget that I couldn't see my grandmother because, you know, things that you were saying. Like, here's even a tweet from the same woman in 2021 saying she doesn't think we should shame people, but we should have individual family pressure. Maybe you have vaccine requirements for things that people want to do, like travel, work, sports, events. Yes, we can have these without shame. And so there's just, it's just interesting, Micah, I think. And this is what I'm saying, is I think there's more and more awareness coming out, maybe not in the mainstream press, but there are more and more people who are starting to question the narrative. And I also think this could be related to some people's fear that that next week in the midterm elections, the Republicans are going to take power and then the Democrats are going to be held responsible for their policies. So, yeah, I think it's pretty interesting. You know, it's pretty interesting to see how it's unfolding. What do you think about this?
Yeah, it's a sticky subject. It's a difficult thing. I don't think that I don't know, you know, I don't know how to deal with such articles, you know, being out there. I'm sure that people who said things that now know that they spoke too soon, if they finally accepted that, they might deal with it one way. But people who haven't yet, they'll also lean back on this article and just say, look, we are under so much pressure. And again, the ends justify the means. You know, we were going to make big decisions about ostracizing, excluding, and ruining your life as much as possible, you know, based on a free choice. But just go ahead and, you know, overlook that now. I say no, just like we said during the whole time, you know, that all these little tyrants and authoritarians were identifying themselves, you know, with their actions. Don't forget that they did these things. Don't forget. And as more and more stuff comes out, hold them accountable. Because, look, if they're going to do it over this, they're definitely going to do it over whatever the heck that else they want, you know? So I don't know. I it's an apologist article, obviously. I don't know. I don't even know where they come from being able to look at themselves after kind of publishing this. Now, I'm going to say that I haven't read the article because I didn't know about it until you brought it today. But, you know, given some of the stuff and the I guess you could say the slant, the direction it's going, the argument it's making. I don't know that I don't know why they're seeking forgiveness. I wouldn't really think that's what they're after, because I don't really blame them for their poor decisions. You know, I just want to move on past them and not empower them anymore, because, look, if you can't drive, I'm not going to be in the car with you. I'm not going to follow your advice on driving. You know, and that's what we're looking at here. We're looking at these people trying to take control the levers of, you could call it legal society, social society, whatever, in all these different ways, using peer pressure, using the media, using exclusion. They said censorship. We can call it that word or not. You know, we talked to that nurse that got let go. We've seen how it's affected people's lives. And we saw the vehement rhetoric, truly, honestly, on both sides. At least that's what the media portrayed, mostly one side. But we saw it from that side because they blasted it every day. So I don't know that forgiveness is really the right word. I don't know, like, what would that mean, like, to forgive them? I don't know that I blame them. I basically expect this to be their nature, and this is the type of people they are. I mean, what do they mean? Forget? Just forget? I don't know.
Yeah.
Out of line.
I think that Emily Ulster, professor at Brown University, might like for us to forget, but I'm kind of with you, Mike. I think that we definitely shouldn't. It's the sort of thing where I was saying this to Miriam earlier. I was showing her this article, like, hey, check out how this is looking. I think these kind of people are concerned about you know, not only reputation looking bad, but maybe potential legal repercussions. Maybe not her because she's not in a position of authority, but still some, a lot of these people did use their voice to promote these ideas, right? And now they're kind of getting ahead of the game. I did want to read just briefly before we move on, just the first two paragraphs so you can kind of get
title, that title right there, the subtitle under it. We need to forgive one another for what we did and said when we were in the dark about COVID. So we made these reaching decisions and we weren't, and we didn't know. It's that same thing again. They're jumping from believing they know something. And now they're like, oh, we didn't know.
Yeah.
That's what you would like us to believe.
But I think
it's important to consider this though. Think about it. These are people that are willing to exercise draconian measures on something that they say they didn't know. You get what I'm saying? They're saying they didn't even know it, but they just did it anyway. We were in the dark. We did the best we could. We didn't know what to do. I mean, so you're basically saying you did a knee-jerk reaction, and we should just get over that and let you take with the wheel whatever. I don't know.
Well, let me show you some of these tweets here. This is an example. Here's a response to her. My mother languished in a nursing home being barred from any visits from her loved ones. She still got COVID anyway. That wasn't what killed her. Loneliness killed her. By the time I could see her, the damage was done. It was too late. Apologize to her urn and we can talk. You know, someone else. Sorry, no, we are not allowed to treat each other like that with impunity. They actively tried to punish us for merely having a different, correct opinion on how to handle COVID. They ostracized us, got us fired, harmed our children, destroyed our economy, and did it with glee.
Indignation. They did it with like almost holy indignation. Like, you know what I'm saying here? They did it.
Oh, yeah.
They were so much the knights of goodness and divine everything that they were here to save the world. And this is what we see. That's the problem with these totalizing concepts that make people believe it's okay to go step on someone because they're doing it for the good of all.
Yep. See somebody else saying, say it louder for the kids permanently disabled by COVID. Dementia had turned my mother into this sweet little girl with mental emotional capacity of 6-year-old. They took her from an environment she knew and the people she loved her and put her in a COVID wing where she curled up into a fetal position and died. I mean, there's just countless stories like this, but I want to just read what Emily's actually arguing. Here's the way she tries to frame her argument, and then we'll move on from here. But if you haven't heard this, guys, this is just be aware. This is the kind of stuff being proposed out there. And you got other officials. The interesting thing too, Micah, is you got other officials who were in a similar position of her promoting this sort of thing. And they're retweeting her saying, I agree with this. I think they're right. Yeah, we should consider amnesty, like they're also concerned. But she writes, in April 2020, with nothing else to do, my family took an enormous number of hikes. We all wore cloth masks that I had made myself. We had a family hand signal, which the person in front of us would use if someone was approaching on the trail. We need to put on our mask. Once, and now this is really disturbing, once when another child got too close to my then 4-year-old son on a bridge, he yelled, social distancing! These precautions were totally misguided. In April 2020, no one got the coronavirus from passing someone else hiking. Outdoor transmission was vanishingly rare. Our cloth masks made of old bandanas wouldn't have done anything anyway. But the thing is, we didn't know. And she just goes on about how she's been reflecting about the lack of information we had and, you know, just how we made certain things that were necessary. But now we realize, and she admits, she's like, the latest figures on learning loss to kids are alarming. Health risks of in-school spread were relatively low, but in summer of 2020, we only had glimmers of information. And she claims reasonable people on both sides advocated on both sides of the debate, and just goes on from here. And really doesn't take any accountability for having, you know, promoted these ideas that have been proven wrong. And again, it's not just that, like, okay, science has changed, right? And so nobody's to blame because we didn't know anything. It's that there were other people claiming and saying, guys, look, we have data showing this is not going to work. This is bad. This is harmful. And those people were shut up. They were censored. They were fired from their jobs. Some of them were stripped of their medical licenses, you know, on and on and on. Right. Like that's why this just disturbs me so much.
It's hard to overlook and forget when someone had power and thought they were righteous, what they did. And you just listed it. They lost their jobs. They closed the economy. They hurt, you know, the working class. They, you know, they indirectly contributed to uncomfortable deaths of elderly people. Many people were afraid to even go to the hospital. Remember that, Derek? We were talking about that for a while. People with other things that they could have gone to the doctor for, would have gone to the doctor if they weren't all put into terror shock mode that they'd get COVID from going to the doctor. You know, so Yeah, I think that that's the thing to remember is that when they had the attention of the world, that's what they did with it.
They turned into authoritarians. They showed their true colors. And that's why we're calling shows tonight's show, The COVID Authoritarians Want Amnesty. You guys, you're listening to Live Free, Think Free. We do this every week on Wednesday evening, typically. We've been doing this for over a decade now. We broadcast live across the internet, and you can find our archives at thehoustonfreethinkers.com. If you're on Spotify and other places like that, you can search Live Free, Think Free, and you should be able to find our show. We post the archives every single week, including the stories. So if you are interested in one of the stories we cover tonight and you want to get more details, you can visit thehoustonfreethinkers.com after the show. We'll have the links posted there and you can get plugged in. And I do want to let you know as well, a big part of the show is playing music. And tonight we're playing two new songs. We're not ready just yet. We got a couple more stories to cover, but in about 10, 15 minutes, we're going to play a brand new song. I'm going to debut another new song, Micah, from my album. I got a new one, and I got a new song from So Below, our friends So Below, based in Houston. So two new songs that we'll be playing for tonight's show. And tomorrow I'm headed back to Houston, so that'll be cool. Johnny hasn't been with us for a while. Johnny's getting married this weekend, and he should be back soon after that as a married man, rejoining Live Free, Think Free. So I'm coming back to town. I'm going to hang out with Johnny and Micah this weekend, and then maybe next week we'll do a show in person. But yeah, just want to make note of that. If you ever want to know more about what we're up to, who we are, our history, the shows we've done, check out thehoustonfreethinkers.com. And speaking of Houston, Micah, I know you got a couple Houston stories. You want to jump to those?
Yeah, let's go ahead and get them. We got the ballot one. I think that's probably the most important. So let's go ahead and start there. Breaking down the 7 Houston bond propositions on the November election ballot. Now, I know most of the other news that you may be hearing is telling you, vote for this person, vote for that person, worry about the judges' races, worry about all this stuff. I don't have time to worry about all them things or to even try to talk to you. I hope that if you're watching this show, you've got some principles. And if you found someone, great. And if you know something going on, cool. But let's just talk about these things for a minute, because, you know, no matter how you feel about any of the principles that any of the characters may have, this is, you know, future debt that the city is going to raise taxes in the long run, or basically contribute to getting this money back to pay for the bonds. You know, they basically got to, you know, the investors buy the bonds, they got to pay back the investment plus interest, right? And we see what's happening. The Fed's already raised interest rates yet again. So, I mean, think about that. Is this the time that we want to go ahead and incur all this on us? And we're not talking that this will go a long way, but let's get into it and see what it is. And maybe you feel like some of them, yeah, let's go in debt for that. And maybe you feel like some, like, oh my God, are we really going in debt for that? And how far are we going in debt? They say almost $500 million. Houston voters will get to decide if they want to approve a $478 million bond to fund a host of projects and improvements across the city. Proposition A, and all you get is yes or no on these, right? It includes $227 million for public safety, including improvements to police and fire stations, even new vehicles. Proposition B calls for $50 million for parks. $500,000 will be set aside for improvement at Herman Park. Proposition C proposes $47 million for animal care, including a new building for BARC. Proposition D includes $33 million for public health improvements and updates to Houston Health Department facilities. Proposition E would set aside $29 million for general permanent improvements like existing city administration buildings. Proposition F proposes $26 million for the public library system. Proposition G calls for $6 million to support the solid waste department. There's no detailed project list for what the bonds would fully fund, but the city said that $194 million of these would go towards projects that have already been approved but not yet funded. So guess we will see. They do say that the bonds will not require an increase in property taxes. So where's the money coming from? Other services the city provides? Or are they just going to issue bonds and not pay them back? I don't know. What do you think about this stuff, Derek? You think the government should just like incur debt for the people that are stuck living in Houston?
I mean, you know, you've always paid attention to the bonds, and it's something that I never really understood before, but it definitely seems to be just a huge area where government spends the taxpayers' money. And obviously there's some of these projects that some people might be like, yeah, you know, I think that's what government should be doing, repairing police stations or improving parks and, you know, things like this, you know, library system, sure, stuff like that. But maybe people aren't really even quite aware of the amount of money that goes into all this, right? Or do you think they pay attention? I mean, are the votes on bonds like just as low of voter turnout as the typical, you know,
probably even lower?
Probably, yeah, that's what I figured.
You know, because by the time they get to the bottom of the ballot, I think a lot of people, they're not even thinking anymore about it. You know, they had to get up to go vote for this judge that they cared about and they met, you know, or they had to get up and go vote Lena out or in, or they had to get up and go vote for whatever county commissioner, et cetera. You know, some politician affected them some way. But by the time they get down to the bonds, and a lot of ways, like you said, the way these things are presented, yeah, you know, you think I want these things, but I don't believe think about what it means that these things aren't just being spent out of the money that they've gathered. You know, this is being a bond initiative. It's going to be paid. It's a debt that, you know, is going to be incurred to the people who invest in the bonds, that they'll expect that money back plus interest. I mean, nobody else loans.
And that debt is repaid by the taxpayer. Like, I mean,
yeah. And what's interesting is they say they won't be an increase. So I guess what's going to happen to pay it back, they just won't fund something else, or they'll juggle some money from somewhere, you know, rather, you know, why not just live within the means and learn to balance what they have? You're muted.
I would say maybe they're going to finally cut fluoride out of the budget and then, you know, reallocate something there.
You know, I think that's a serious thing in a way, right? But we're talking $4 million there, and that's what, you know, a fraction of this, you know?
Yeah, it's nothing compared to the overall larger money going there. Do you want to jump to this HISD one? I saw you got something about, you know, Houston's going green.
They're trying. They're selling that, you know, that whole agenda thing, that whole idea. And, you know, maybe it's good, but check out the numbers. Houston ISD is going to add some electric propane buses with $6.2 million in federal funds to cut emissions. And, you know, if we cut into it, Houston Independent School District will replace some heavy polluting buses with new, cleaner ones. Texas school districts are awarded almost $51 million to shift from diesel buses, and of that, the 6.2 is headed to HISD. HISD has a fleet of 1,033 buses. That's a heck of a lot of buses, man. Think about that. Transporting 15,000 students annually. 25 of them are going to get replaced by the clean vehicles. Okay. All right. 25 are being replaced. All right. At the rate of $6 million, 25 buses. Oh, wow. That's almost $5 million a bus, right? And then like $3 million plus a bus. The additions are expected to hit the ground in 2024. Diesel buses, the ones targeted for replacement in this initiative, are linked to asthma and other harmful health conditions. And, you know, they basically argue about how it's a win for the environment. And I do think, you know, we should try to be more efficient. So I don't know how to feel about that. But nonetheless,
well, it's interesting. It says right here, it goes further. It says this will fund the purchase of 2,493 American made buses, the majority of which will be electric. HISD will add 10 propane buses and 15 electric buses to their fleet with these funds, which, I mean, again,
that's
such a tiny amount.
That part is not of the 6 million that HISD gets. That's of the 913 million that the US EPA is putting towards of it. That fund will make.
And, well, even that is such a small dent, though, right? They're getting hundreds of millions of dollars and they're adding 10 buses and, you know, 10 propane buses and 15 buses. And I'm not like trying to attack this per se, but I am going to say that, like, one of the big reasons people are pushing back, like, and we've seen the last few months, watch the Dutch farmers protesting against different Green New Deal rules against nitrogen, which is affecting their farming. We've seen Indian farmers protesting. And now in places like Germany, there, you know, there's talk of like having to ration diesel fuel and other kinds of fuel, like whether or not people are going to have enough heat for the winter. And there are some people who are blaming a lot of these, you know, Agenda 2030 sort of attempts at sustainable development, but it's being done, of course, in a way where the government, where it's as cumbersome as possible, as wasteful as possible. And, you know, I'm not surprised, but so it's just, to me, it's kind of astounding that, like, what'd you say? It's $913 million. And then some of that is going to go towards HISD. I guess maybe each school district gets 10 new buses, and they call that like, hey, we're now green. We're sustainable. I think it's just a lot of greenwashing.
I do, you know, and I can see that. And I do at the same time see that, you know, every little step helps. But I think that's how it is. You know, they get us all hyped up on it. And then they're like, okay, look, we're going in that direction. It's going to cost an awful lot, but we're going to go in that direction. And, you know, they did say on a positive note that, and I don't know if it's true, that the electric buses somehow being a new technology will cost less in maintenance. I don't know. I don't think it's been out there tested well enough to know that they'll really be less in maintenance. But they do say the consumption, the fuel consumption costs will be less. So, yeah.
I do think there are legitimate, you know, discussions to be had about this whole thing on both sides, because the other thing, I was having this conversation. I just recorded a podcast the other day with James Corbett, for those who know him, where we were discussing climate change and just the arguments on different sides of that particular discussion. But one of the things that I think people who support these ideas and electric vehicles and this push sort of forget the cost of just, like, they're talking about redesigning the entire global economic system, like in the words of the World Economic Forum and other folks and King Charles and, you know, lots of governmental officials. They're trying to, you know, remake capitalism and redesign it, make it nature-based and nature-friendly and environmental social governance skills, governance scores. And just, there's a whole new thing coming into play here. But the amount of money, the amount of infrastructure to create this world they want, I mean, it's the costs are in the trillions, right? And that's what people were kind of balking at the Green New Deal a while back when they were trying to push that through and the Build Back Better agenda and all this stuff. Like, I don't think the younger generations who are hearing this and are like, we got to save the planet, because they've been hearing since they were born that the planet's about to die, that they fully grasp what these folks are trying to push.
I got one thing to say real quick, and then I want to hit one more part of this story, but in relation to what you're saying, these people are not necessarily, and maybe some people don't recognize the connect here and why it might matter. These people are not necessarily the best versed at busing or whatever it is that they're trying to influence. They're not necessarily the best versed at, you know, vehicle creation or route management. You get what I mean? These the people pushing a green agenda, the Prince Charles, the King Charleses, and the et cetera people like that. They're not like the people who know how to run a business or know how to do these things. I think it's kind of difficult when you have someone else, you know, from an outside field come in and tell you how you ought to do your business. So I think that's going to be a bit of an impediment too, because you have, you know, all this influence that's going to cut into the bottom line in different ways. So let me hit this last part on this one article and then we can move forward real quick. This guy, Harrison Humphreys, he happens to be climate programs manager over at Air Alliance Houston. He said that diesel buses that create polluted air in and around the bus. So the biggest direct benefit from these buses is basically just to the kids right there and around the bus. So instead of like huffing diesel exhaust while waiting for their bus, these poor kids won't be exposed to that. But he goes on to say, and this is a very important point, diesel school buses in Houston really only contribute a small sliver of the overall emissions out there. There's just not very many school buses running compared to all the other vehicles and all the other sources of emission in the region. So I think that, especially here in the, you know, Gulf Coast, we got Pasadena, we got Texas City, we've got all this stuff, all these, you know, refining plants, and we've got, you know, a huge major shipping area. So you got the trucks coming in and out of the port of Houston, as well as a massive population driving cars of various types and having fires and all kinds of stuff. So I do think that that's an important point, that these buses are a sliver You know, if
yeah, I think that is a good point. I'm glad you brought that one up. I saw that too. Yeah, well, I'm glad you brought those stories up. Just let people know how their money's being spent. Because, I mean, even if you're not based in Houston, chances are there's probably similar programs. Because if you noticed in those stories, it wasn't just – that wasn't Houston taxpayer money just coming out of nowhere. Well, the budget – the bonds were. But in this case, the second one, it was about federal grant money, right? There was money coming from the feds. So there's probably federal money coming to your area.
Almost $1 billion.
Similar programs, whether you think they're good or bad, that, you know, they're taking place. I want to hit one more quick one before we go to our music break. And this one is a little health. And then if you want to hit the mosquitoes, I know you had something to say about mosquitoes, but maybe we'll hold that after the break, because I think that is a good one too. So first I want to mention for anybody in Houston this weekend, I forgot to say this earlier, but Saturday, which I don't think I'm going to be able to make it because I'm going to be at Johnny's wedding, really awesome punk show taking place in Houston. Total Chaos, who are friends and supporters of our show. We play them sometimes, and they were their song was part of our intro in the past. But them, Black Flag, TSOL, the Dickies, really awesome punk show taking place off Travis Street downtown at Rise Rooftop. Never even heard of it, but should be cool. Just want to throw that out there in case anybody sees that.
They've done a lot of old school like rock bands and stuff up there. Members cool. of old famous bands rather than the band, you know, that sort of thing.
Yeah, these are definitely old punks here, so not surprising. But yeah, right, shout out right. to Rob of Total Chaos, a supporter of our show. All right, I want to mention this. I mentioned it in brief last week, and this is just soup. You know, there's not much to say, but I know there are people who followed way back 2 years ago whenever we were talking about this fluoride trial, this fluoride lawsuit between the Fluoride Action Network and the US EPA. And long story short, they sued them saying that they violated the TSCA, the Toxic Substances Control Act, and that fluoride was a violation of this act. They were able to successfully bring it to court after years of wrangling with the EPA. And then over the course of several weeks, they presented expert evidence. And that lawsuit, that those hearings ended up kind of being put on a pause. The judge said they wanted to see what this upcoming National Toxicology Program report was going to say. This was in 2020. This was supposed to come out in 2021. Here we are in late 2022, and the report still hasn't come out. And there have been people accusing the NTP of dragging their feet, of maybe the EPA interfering in some ways. There's definitely concerns of that. So the Fluoride Action Network went back to the EPA, to the judge, and said, hey, can we just get a ruling on this? Like, do we need to start a new trial again? We'll represent our evidence, everything that we've got. And then let's get you to make a ruling, because, you know, this could be years before the NTP, you know, ever makes a ruling. So there was some success in this, where the judge lifted the stay in the fluoride trial. The judge overseeing the anti-fluoridation group's long-running suit over the EPA's denial of their petition to ban fluoride under the TSCA has lifted the years-long stay to try to obtain the key report I was just talking about. So he's basically saying, like, okay, the parties, they can go forward. He's going to make a review of the case, and he'll determine if it should be considered in a actual ruling, or if the EPA, you know, should go back to the drawing board. You know, we don't know where it's going to go, but basically, this is one step in the right direction of slow moving courts moving a little bit faster, basically. So, I mean, the thing about this trial, the reason I'm following it, even though it's like inching along the last couple years, is because if this is somehow successful in this, the Fluoride Action Network and their attorneys who are doing amazing work, and the experts who presented evidence showing fluoridation affecting the IQ of children, affecting thyroids, affecting hip bones, affecting kidneys, liver, all sorts of different things. This is being presented in court for the first time. That if they're successful, it will be the end of water fluoridation in the United States. Of course, you could bet that if the judge ruled in their favor, there would be appeals, and this could drag on for years, and maybe even it could make its way to the Supreme Court. But yeah, I just want to update anybody who cares about that and who, you know, follows that. And also, I think it's important to me, Micah, because this is one of the old school issues, like one of the first things that I really started paying attention to back in 2010. That was one of the first things I personally was kind of waking up to in Houston. And we started Fluoride Free Houston, and we tried for years to stop it and get them to take it out of the budget, and unsuccessfully. But yeah, so we'll see. Maybe the courts will work. Do you want to get into that mosquito one now, or you want to wait till after the music?
Let's get into some music. We're 34 right. minutes in the show. It's probably a good yeah,
music spot. Break. All right, cool. All right, guys. Well, I'm going to premiere a brand new song. I played one last week called Clarity. This is another new song just recently mixed, not even out anywhere on social media. You're just going to hear it exclusively preview here on Live Free, Think Free for the first time. And you probably won't hear it again until we release the album in late November or December. This is called I Can See Me. And for anybody who wants to check out more of my work, you can find me under the name 33 Is Here on Spotify, Apple, YouTube, Odyssey, Telegram, all that good stuff. And this song, it's called I Can See Me. It's kind of like about, it's like the end of the album. The album's about transformation. Transmutation is what it's called. So it's talking about being in some dark places, going through some dark things, thinking that drugs and alcohol are going to solve your problems, and then kind of starting to wake up to that. And this is sort of the end of that journey. So this is more a bit of an optimistic song. I hope you guys enjoy it.
Drugs and alcohol solving your problems? Is that what you're saying?
Waking up to them not solving your problems, realizing that wasn't the answer. Yeah. So, yeah, stay tuned. We'll be right back. This is Live Free, Think Free. This song is called I Can See Me from 33.
Yo, it took for me to turn 33 before I could really see what this world meant to me. It's like a light switched on and all my doubt is gone. I can weather the storm cause I got the world in my palm. Ain't got no fear of flop cause I'm heading to the top to find whoever's there now and knock them off. I ain't got no time to wait for the proper time or place cause I'm here right now to claim my crown. So step into my ring and let me know how you're feeling. If you understand me now, let's reach for the ceiling. Cause we're reaching higher heights than we ever have before. They keep telling us to stop, but we only want more. I'm talking about freedom and loving your heart. They want us to forget as they tear us apart. But how do we stop them from dropping these bombs? They keep coming at us and we keep singing our songs. Songs of love and freedom, prayers to the seventh generation. I know it's our time, the new paradigm begins. Yeah. And shed our fears for a moment. I know it's hard, the dark clouds are an omen. We got brothers and sisters dying of dope. Everyone feels alone these days, can barely cope with the heaviness of a world where most chase paper. They can see the planet's dying, we desecrate her. You wanna go viral to fill the hole inside. There's no need to feel empty, it's only a ride. I know the feeling, the darkness can consume you. It's all about perspective, sometimes you need a new view to see who's been down for you the whole time. I ain't about to give up, I'm here to claim what's mine. So I have to steady myself and keep myself calm. I'm prepared to ready myself in case they want me gone. But I've been to hell, they don't want me neither. I'll try not to die too soon, but I'm an overachiever.
Thank you.
Those were some rosé smooth beats. It sounded really good, man. I like the sound. I like the sounds in the background. I barely even managed to digest all the lyrical poetry going on because I started slipping into just the sounds.
But that dude, yeah, awesome. Thank you. I appreciate it. Yeah, that's a. I see there's a comment from our friend Karen. Karen, that was not Jim. We have a fellow mutual friend, Jim, who plays saxophone and lots of other instruments. But Jim will be playing that live with me at the Greater Reset here in Mexico in January. We've been working on that, but he's not the actual on the recording. But yeah, there's some of the songs like that. They've got a real groovy kind of jazzy, you know, I'm trying to create some songs, like I'm trying to tell a story. And so some of the songs are definitely like go cruise in your car late at night and put this on. So yeah, that was 33. I Can See Me. I am 33. You can find my music under 33 Is Here on YouTube, on Odyssey. I got a Telegram channel, Spotify, all that. I put it on my upcoming album, Transmutation. So, yeah, let's go ahead and get into it. Mike, you want to jump into this mosquito story?
Yeah, you know, and I'm going to say something about this. I found this because I got bit up by some mosquitoes, and I looked to find out some facts about mosquitoes. And then after looking at the facts about some mosquitoes, there was this story on the same site, scienceinfo.net. I did the about to figure out about them. They seemed fairly legit, but I haven't done that much digging in the background. But since we talked about these mosquitoes before, and genetically modified mosquitoes being unleashed amongst the people of Houston, I mean, let go and be free in the nature to interfere with the breeding process of female mosquitoes. But yeah, so it turns out that in Brazil, they released, I guess, 450,000 genetically modified mosquitoes. So don't swallow them. they say it led to unintended genetic chaos of the mosquito population. That sounds serious, right? They wanted to basically trigger an early death to limit the breeding of mosquito populations. According to scientists, the main purpose of the experiment is to limit the spread of mosquito-borne pathogens such as yellow fever, dengue fever, chikungunya, and Zika fever in the region. I'm sure these are all very serious things, you know. Oxitec Biotech Company came up with the idea to genetically modify a mosquito. They call this mosquito the Ox513A. It's basically a mosquito that's created from three different mosquito strains. Yeah, you know what I'm saying? A Cuban mosquito, a Mexican mosquito, an Aedes aegypti, and some other things, you know, I didn't even know. You know, how do you mix three and make one? I don't know. They did it, though. Genetically modified mosquitoes have been introduced into the wild with the aim of limiting the number of mosquitoes. Main characteristic of the mosquito breed is its early death. Females of the natural mosquito breed mate with the Ox513A. Their offspring will not survive until adulthood, and the Ox513 mosquito strain is implanted with a fluorescent protein gene to make it a freak, right? Which helps it to glow, allowing it to be easily identified for young offspring born from them. In addition, females who ever mate with the Ox513A will also be weak and unable to continue breeding. And so it's really like a bad move for them, right? Like they think the female mosquito is so dumb, they're going to mate with this thing that makes them weak and unable to continue breeding. I don't know. Beginning in 2013, for 27 consecutive months, Oxitec has released nearly 500,000 Ox513A male mosquitoes each week, like clockwork. Oh, man. Every week into the wild. That's like 52
million. The stuff is crazy, man.
52 million mosquitoes, more than that. According to the initial estimates, the entry of Ox513A into the wild will not pose any risk to the residents. turned out that this failed. They're saying it's turning into a failure. In the first 18 months, the results showed optimism. As predicted by the researchers, nearly 60% of the regional mosquitoes carried the unique genome of the Ox513A, and only 3 to 4% of the offspring survived to the reproductive age. This initial result was described by scientists as a great success. However, after 18 months, the number of mosquitoes in Jacobina began to recover rapidly, returning to the same level as before the experiment. Notably, in the mosquito community, now appears some sort of discrimination. Accordingly, female mosquitoes of the native species will be able to identify and avoid mating with genetically engineered males. There was concern that the genetic diversity of a species would create a stronger species than before. In addition, new evidence suggests that the offspring of the OX513A are not weakening as expected. Many of them are apparently well enough to survive into adulthood and reproduction. Currently, the existing mosquito in Jacobina have inherited the genetic characteristics from many different mosquito strains. According to researchers who oppose Oxitec, the genetic diversity of a species will create a stronger species than before. This view is currently being denied by Oxitec. Oxitec is also facing many allegations from various organizations around the world. Most of them focus on Oxitec conducting field trials without adequate research. Never! Causing unintended consequences. Many research centers have demonstrated that releasing genetically modified organisms into the wild can have unpredictable consequences.
Imagine that. Imagine that. You know, the thing about it that's crazy to me about this, Mike, is that I'm going to pull up a couple links because I want to show people how relevant this is. And like right now, I'm glad you pulled this story up because they specifically, because I've been following this story for, I'll pull this up first. I've been following this story for a couple of years because Houston, Harris County, where we're originally based from, that's one of the areas where they have been planning to bring these mosquitoes for years. And the other thing to mention is that Oxitec is funded in large part by Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. It's another one of the companies that he's invested in doing all these weird things. So here's an article I want to show you guys. If anybody's interested, you can go to the Houston, theconsciousresistance.com, my website. And if you just search mosquitoes, you can see reports I did. I did two of them in 2020 where I actually called the city of Houston. This one's called Bill Gates Genetically Engineered Mosquitoes in Houston. And then July 2020, winter Oxitec mosquitoes coming to Houston. And then again in May 2021, potential release of GE mosquitoes. Probably I should do another one for this year because I'm trying to keep an eye on it and I forget about it, but because I think they're waiting for nobody to pay attention. Because here's the other news that happened last year, in case we missed this one, didn't cover it. Last year, the EPA approved the release of GMO mosquitoes in Houston and Harris County. Actually, this was late 2020. So yeah, think about that. They've had that for a while. But I also found this article, another little update on that. Because look, they're planning, the EPA is going to allow them to do it. And this from the Texas Signal. In May 2021, our genetically engineered mosquitoes coming to Houston. And here's the update. He says, while it's true that the EPA approved the use of Oxitec strain of this particular mosquito in Harris County last year, state and local authorities would have to approve their use and work out a deal with Oxitec before anything happened. They say they reached out to Harris County Public Health, and this is what they said. At this time, there are no agreements or plans in place to move forward with the Oxitec project. While we have had discussions with Oxitec previously about a potential partnership, those were paused in 2019. And this is what they told me in 2020, that they had paused it because of COVID. But obviously things are changing now and that might not be the case. Here's one more relevant to what you're talking about here, Micah, and even another scarier element is that now mosquitoes are being used as vaccine factories is what Bill Gates and others have called them. This is just 2 months ago. I think we covered this in September. A box of 200 mosquitoes did the vaccinating in this malaria trial. That's not a joke. And look, they show this guy's swollen arm from getting, or this woman from getting bit up by a bunch of mosquitoes. So that's the future. They say they might be able to, mosquitoes might be able to play that role. Here's another example of that in action. This is from science.org. Brazil will release billions of lab-grown mosquitoes to combat infectious disease, but will it work? This is back in 2016. So think about that. 2016, that's 6 years ago. And now we're at the point where they're talking about mosquitoes as vaccine factories, GMO mosquitoes. So there's a whole lot going on in this mosquito conversation. So I'm glad you brought it to the table, Micah. A lot happened there.
Yeah, we should have played Blood Transfusion by Friendly Neighborhood Anarchists. But yeah, there's a lot going on. I mean, they're violent little critters, and obviously they can get up in you. And now they're starting to learn how to get them to transmit things to you. That doesn't sound fun at all.
No, it doesn't. Well, guys, you're listening to Live Free, Think Free here. We got a couple more stories. I know I got one that I want to cover about something's up with the FBI. I know we've known that for a while, but we got a little more information about that. I know you saw this latest one about the leaks from the DHS. I saw you put that one in there. We'll get into that here in a couple minutes in case you haven't seen that. Just more. I mean, I feel like the last few weeks, Mike, or last few months, like we've had stories about the social media lawsuits revealing more and more about collusion between governments and big tech. And just we're getting so much more information just showing how interconnected the state and the big corporations, particularly the tech corporations, are connected. Yes, leaks we're going to go over in just a few minutes relate to that because it's about how the DHS is going to work with social media to police misinformation. So, you know, this if you had any doubt that the government and big tech, the intelligence community were working together, I think that those lines are very quickly being erased, whatever lines do separate them. But let's go ahead and jump into this first one here. I got this just a brief update for anybody who's followed. In case you haven't, you probably should know something about this. There is a name that sometimes you're not allowed to say. You might even get banned on certain platforms for mentioning him. His name is Seth Rich. Seth Rich worked for the Hillary Clinton campaign in 2016. He died in 2016, allegedly in just a random robbery in D.C. However, he has long been suspected to have been the source for the 2016 WikiLeaks dumps from the DNC, the DNC hacks that, you know, they like to blame Russia on. There's long been evidence that it was not an outside hack by Russia, but that the information had to come from within, and that somebody, maybe Seth Rich, might have smuggled out a USB drive with data, something like that, and he might have lost his life for it. That's still an unsolved mystery. So people have been trying to get to the bottom of it. And just about a month ago, there was a court ruling saying that the FBI has to provide all the information that they have available, you know, obviously with allowing for certain redactions that they have on his computer, because his computer's never been released to the public. Again, there's big suspicions that he was the leaker, that he, and even Julian Assange had kind of hinted at Seth Rich being the source for WikiLeaks. He wouldn't come out and say it, but he did mention his name and talked about him. And obviously Julian Assange is still suffering because he's being punished for the 2016 leaks, which exposed Hillary Clinton, John Podesta, a lot of nasty, disturbing things in there, and obviously showing the corruption in the DNC. So that's why this case matters. And now the FBI is asking a U.S. court to reverse its order that it should produce information from Seth Rich's laptop. If the computer does not, the Bureau wants, or excuse me, if the court does not, the Bureau wants 66 years to produce the information. Why would they want 66 years to delay this information on his laptop? Just a simple, lowly, not important worker is what we've been told. He was not, he supposedly didn't have access to any of these systems. It's all conspiracy. If he was just a, you know, regular staffer in the DNC, why would they want to hide his information for 66 years? Rich was a Democratic National Committee staffer when he was killed on a street in Washington in mid-2016, and no one has ever been arrested for his murder. U.S. District Judge Amos Mazant, an Obama appointee, ruled in September that the FBI must hand over the information from the computer to Brian Huddleston, a Texas man who filed a Freedom of Information Act request for the info. The FBI's assertion that the privacy interest Rich's family members hold outweighs the public interest was rejected by the judge, who said the FBI cited no relevant case law supporting the argument. But the ruling was erroneous, the U.S. lawyers are now saying in their new filing. And so, you know, it's just some legalese, but it's basically the FBI trying to say, hey, we don't want to give up this data. We're trying our hardest to stop this. In this new filing, government lawyers say the FBI never extracted the data from his computer, which it revealed was as originating with the law enforcement agency. They said the information is on a compact disc containing images of the laptop. Quote, the FBI did not open an investigation into the murder of Seth Rich, nor did it provide investigative or technical assistance to any investigation. As a result, the FBI has never extracted the data from the compact disc and never processed the information. So they're claiming that the reason they can't answer this is because they don't have anything there. But then at the same time, the FBI is asking for 66 years or 500 pages a month in order to produce the stuff that he's asking for. So they're pretty much either saying, like, we want to drag our feet, or no, we're not going to show anything. I don't know where that's going, how long that could take. I mean, obviously what JFK was 60 years ago, they're still holding on to documents from then. So will we ever see what's on Seth Rich's computer? Will the truth ever come out? Will Julian Assange be given, you know, a pardon? I don't know. Pretty soon here, we're going to see if he's going to be extradited to the U.S. and he might not survive that. You know, he's barely surviving right now. So yeah. Anything you want to say on that, Micah, before we jump to this DHS story?
I think you said most everything, and we only have so much time. It is a curious thing, and I guess their main point is, since they didn't investigate the murder, they never did this already. So, you know, this is a new job all of a sudden, like a special service from them.
Yeah, we'll see. If anybody, I might reach out to that guy. It says he's a Texas man, so that might be interesting, the guy who's filing the FOIA request, just to hear what exactly he's trying to get and maybe get some more insight to that. So stay tuned for that. But let's jump to this story. It's coming from The Intercept. I'll let you take it from here, Micah.
Yeah, no doubt. And it's much more developed than we have time to get into. But it turns out that DHS is, if you didn't know, quietly broadening its effort to curb speech it considers dangerous. So, you know, DHS, you know, the people who brought you TSA and all kinds of other things and have, you know, post 9/11 world. Years of internal DHS memos, emails, and documents obtained via leaks and ongoing lawsuit, as well as public documents, illustrate an expansive effort by the agency to influence tech platforms. The work, much of which remains unknown to the American public, came into view earlier this year when DHS announced, and you'll remember this, the new Disinformation Governance Board, a panel designed to police misinformation, false information spread unintentionally, disinformation, which is false information spread intentionally, and malinformation, factual information shared out of context with harmful intent. Because, you know, now they know the intent, right? That allegedly threatens U.S. interests. And you got to ask yourself, what are U.S. interests? Are they your rights and nothing more? Oh, I don't know. Anyway, threatens U.S. interests. Well, the board was widely ridiculed, immediately scaled back, and then shut down within a few months. Other initiatives are underway as DHS pivots to monitoring social media now that its original mandate, the war on terror, has wound down. Behind closed doors and through pressure on private platforms, U.S. government has used its power to try to shape online discourse. According to meeting minutes and other records appended to a lawsuit filed by Missouri Attorney General Eric Schmidt, who is also running for Senate, discussions have ranged from the scale and scope of government intervention and online discourse to the mechanics of streamlining takedown requests for false and intentionally misleading information. Platforms have got to get comfortable with government. It's really interesting how hesitant they remain, Microsoft executive Matt Masterson, a former DHS official. And in March...
Imagine that, a former intelligence official now working for a big tech company.
In a March meeting, Laura Demlow, an FBI official, warned that the threat of subversive information on social media could undermine support for the U.S. government. Demlow, because, you know, support for the U.S. government's so high. According to notes of the discussion attended by senior executives from Twitter and JP Morgan Chase, those are two companies you want to be hanging out with, right? Stress that we need a media infrastructure that is held accountable. We do not coordinate with other entities when making content moderation decisions, and we independently evaluate content in line with the Twitter rules, a spokesperson for Twitter wrote in a statement to The Intercept. There is a formalized process for government officials to directly flag content on Facebook, and this is the main thing to get to, I think, and request that it be throttled or suppressed through a special Facebook portal that requires a government or law enforcement email to use. At the time of writing, the content request system at facebook.com/xtakedown/login is still live. DHS and Meta, the parent company of Facebook, did not respond to any requests for comments. The FBI declined comments. DHS mission to fight disinformation stemming from concerns around Russian influence in the 2016 presidential election began taking shape during the 2020 election over efforts to shape discussions around vaccine policy during coronavirus pandemic.
Well, Micah, look on, for those who are looking on screen, I just clicked on in the article you're reading. This is the actual Facebook document, and it's literally called Government Reporting System.
Mm-hmm. The GRS.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah. And it turns out, you know, basically, you know, despite, I guess one of the big things is that despite that, you know, the disinformation government board, governance board, whatever you want to call it, it, you know, there was a bit of a backlash and it kind of went away. One of the products that came out of it was that, and that's still there. See, so that's kind
of. Yeah, I think it just shows us that, like you said, there was this uproar when it initially happened. Everybody was like, "Oh my God!" There's having literally the Ministry of Truth, the Disinformation Governance Board, and that was that lady out there that was, she was going to be the head of it, and it got shut down really before anybody could do anything, and then. Now it's like, guess what? These things are happening just under different names, different programs.
Yeah, I think it's going on. Also, just to realize the shift from in DHS from, you know, foreign threats, et cetera. And we've known it the whole time. Look who they started scanning on the airport every day. You take your shoes off and your belts off and everything, right? But yeah, now it's, you know, basically turned into thought policing us. You know,
it's becoming clear that it was always about the domestic front. It was always, this is what people like, you know, I hate to say it, but Jones and others from the very beginning and plenty of people, Ron Paul and others in the 2000s were warning about and were saying, this is what Department of Homeland Security is going to come from. And maybe especially for anyone born post 9/11 or just too young to really remember 9/11, you might not really fully grasp like how much that changed things in that shift. And there were plenty of people who were like, the idea of even the Department of Homeland Security was just abhorrent to them. Like that alone was like, oh my God, what direction are we going in? And now that's just a normal thing. People don't even question. It's just a part of government. And here they are now, their focus is policing so-called disinformation in the domestic front.
Yeah.
Definitely not a step in a positive direction.
Well, I will say it makes you question how much information you really are getting access to in your own feed. Not that, you know.
Oh, yeah. And I mean, I think that also you showed just a moment ago the previous statement about throttling traffic. I mean, this is why, you know, I don't have a huge, huge following. But I mean, say for just as an example, I have 23,000 followers on Twitter and 5 or 6 people comment on it. Maybe it's not the content I'm putting out. It's not good enough. But you see this around different content creators who are talking about so-called controversial things. People might have hundreds of thousands of followers and they're still only reaching maybe 1% of that audience. And you tend to see it like, you know, over the years, independent media has learned how to game social media. We learned that, for example, on Facebook, if you share a picture, like for example, if I share a picture of myself and Miriam, it's going to get 500, 600 likes. And then for a day or two after that, my page kind of gets a spike because there's traffic. They're letting, you know, the algorithms feeding traffic there. Then I post something questioning the COVID shots, and then there's a huge drop in traffic, and then there's like nobody seeing any of my stuff for days, and I have to.
You're supposed to say,
I have to literally say like, "Hey guys, if you see this, like this or comment, because I'm not seeing anybody." Or again, I'll post a picture of Miriam and I, and then boom, everybody sees it. It's just it's clear that there's manipulation going on. We've known this for years, but now we have the documentation of it and a Facebook government reporting portal. Insane. All right. Anything else you want to say on that before we move on, Micah?
No, I mean, we're winding down at this point, but yeah. There's a lot more. And I do want to recommend that people check out, you know, the articles on the HoustonFreethinkers.com. The FBI, I mean, I guess we could read the key takeaways. Work is primarily being done by CISA, a DHS subagency tasked with protecting critical infrastructure. So our thoughts are basically, you know, DHS, the FBI, and several media entities are having biweekly meetings. Yeah. DHS considered countering disinformation relating to content that undermines trust in financial systems and courts. So, you know, think about that. Will it become disinformation because it undermines trust? You know, like something true that happened, like the banksters getting bailed out or, you know, the inflation rate? Or is it only if it's false and say we say the inflation rate is outside what the government statistics say it is?
I think that's the key. It's not so much about whether or not what you're saying is actually false. It's whether it hurts the homeland or whether it's a danger to national security or whether, you know, all those things. And it sounds like based on that little brief list about like, oh, people who are trying to undermine trust in the U.S. government, undermine trust in the financial institutions. It's like they don't want us to talk about any of the fun stuff, from what I can gather. All right, let's move on. We got a couple more here. I just want to mention really briefly, I talked about this last week, my ongoing investigation into Utah. I put out part one of my new series, which is probably just going to be two pieces, maybe three, called Kate's Story. We released last week at thelastamericanvagabond.com. It's called Kate's Story, former associate of David Hamblin, survivor of ritual abuse in Utah, comes forward. And I encourage you to check it out. There's a written article about this woman, Kate Talley, coming forward, knowing the man who's recently been arrested for being involved in ritualistic abuse in Utah. She knows him and has been involved in his story. And at the end of this article, there's an interview with her you can see. And tomorrow, so if you're hearing this live, tomorrow, Thursday, I'll be releasing part two of Kate's story, where she's going to go even deeper into what happened to her as a child, which, you know, is unfortunately pretty messed up stuff. But she's coming forward and she's trying to seek accountability. She's also naming names of people within the church who were abusing her. So I encourage you to check out the original part at thelastamericanvagabond.com, and you can see the second part tomorrow at theconsciousresistance.com. Now we're going to jump to our last couple stories. I got one international. I know you got another one, Micah. I just wanted to throw this out because it relates to the U.S. and Mexico. And you're in the U.S. and I'm in Mexico. And we, it seems like we both eat food, probably care about genetically modified foods or what's going in our diet. This is interesting. Just a couple days ago, exclusive from Reuters, Mexico to proceed with GMO corn ban seeks international grain deals. And there's just a couple of things I want to mention. First off, if you didn't know, Mexico has previously said they were going to ban GMOs starting in 2024. This was done by AMLO, the current president. And it says here, Mexico is considering direct agreements with farmers in the U.S., Argentina, and Brazil to secure non-GMO yellow corn imports, the country's deputy agriculture minister said, adding that a 2024 ban on GM corn would not be amended. You know, first of all, I think it's really weird that they're talking about export imports because, and again, I've only been in Mexico a couple of years, but there's a lot of corn in Mexico, and there's definitely corn's sacred to a lot of different indigenous communities in the U.S. and in Mexico, and just through Central and South America, the corn is, and maybe to people all around the world. And so there definitely are indigenous communities that are trying to protect their corn and avoid it getting contaminated by GMO seeds and things like that. So I find that interesting that they're talking about importing it, because as far as I can tell, there's a lot of corn here too. Deputy Agriculture Minister Victor Suarez told Reuters that Mexico is on track to have its U.S. imports of yellow corn used primarily for livestock feed when the ban comes into effect in 2024. So think about that. They're basically saying they're going to cut their imports of the U.S. yellow corn, because that U.S. yellow corn, as most people know, is 98%, 99% genetically modified in the United States. It's grown in Iowa, Monsanto's companies, Bayer, Monsanto's companies, fields, line the Midwest of the U.S. They're all over the place, and Syngenta and other GM companies, biotechnology companies. So that's interesting, right? Is that they're saying because there's a ban come into effect, they're gonna have their U.S. imports, which mainly goes to livestock feed. And they talk about there's many alternatives here, but there's another part I want to get to, and that is, of course, that there are some people pushing back against this that aren't happy about this. Let's get down here to the bottom. It says that Mexico President AMLO in 2020, he decreed that they were going to phase out GM corn and glyphosate by 2024. And his supporters are saying that genetically modified seeds can contaminate Mexico's age-old native varieties, like I was just saying a moment ago. However, U.S. farm lobbies contend that the ban will cause billions of dollars of economic damage to both countries and have urged Washington to dispute it under the U.S.-Mexico-Canada agreement, which Trump signed, the USMCA. And you got a Mexican official here basically saying, as far as I can tell, we haven't violated the USMCA, saying, quote, "The country was under no obligation to buy and grow GM corn. We care and we respect and care for the trade agreement, but the USMCA is not God, nor is it our constitution," this Mexican official Suarez said. And he said that Mexico would possibly make an announcement in the second half of 2023 when asked whether Mexico would clarify the future of U.S. imports. However, he said there'll be no modification. So they're planning on really trying to just lessen their dependence on outsiders. And typically, as we've seen, Micah, you know this, like in Central America and in the Middle East, like when countries start trying to become independent of the U.S. or the petrodollar or these kinds of you know, first world nations and their so-called help, their loans and their money. Sometimes, you know, democracy comes a calling for them. So it says this is all part of AMLO's campaign to make Mexico self-sufficient and everything from energy to food. Local corn production has slightly increased under him from 1% to 2% per year through free fertilizers, irrigation expansions, and other incentives, mainly for small and medium-sized farms. And he says he's confident that Mexico will make up about 8 million tons of corn it would no longer import from U.S. farmers after 2024. And the government's working to make agreements with local corn growers to increase production. So, yeah. But I found that was interesting that it's the U.S. officials like saying, hey, we might have to try to see if they're violating our trade agreement because they don't want to buy our GMO corn that we're growing over here. It's, I think, it's interesting. We'll see, right? Because there's also other
non-GMO corn grower in the U.S., you should try to get that stuff to Mexico.
They definitely don't want, you know, anybody getting outside of that paradigm, I think. And this is interesting, too, because I've also seen other news where Mexican officials and Canadian officials have floated the idea again. And this is an old idea, Micah, you'll remember, floated the idea again of some sort of North American union, that the idea that there should be a closer, you know, they just talk about like we need to tighten our relationships between our three countries. But obviously these kinds of issues are you know, things that separate them. And I'm thankful to be in Mexico and see this. Now, will this play out in reality? I don't know, because one thing that's both a benefit and a negative about Mexico and countries like Mexico is that when the government says something, it doesn't necessarily always mean it affects the real world or that that's how things are going to play in real life or that people listen, right? So it's like it could be a positive thing said in the news, but it's not necessarily always going to play out that way, because there are other stories of how in some parts of the country up in the Yucatan that Monsanto has tried to bring in GMO crops and get farmers to start growing them because they know that once they're in, you know, then it'll just start growing. And then basically also Monsanto might have a claim for farmers now being, you know, using their patented product and maybe owing them money. So we'll see where it goes. But I just found that that's interesting, right? That the U.S. is complaining that Mexico is trying to take steps to becoming more self-sufficient and not using GMO corn.
Well, one thing I just learned in another article is that popcorn is not GMO because the strain that they use to make popcorn is not GMO. They don't make GMO popcorn. I never knew that. They said so.
Even you're telling me that popcorn at the movie theater that's like covered in some artificial butter is not GMO?
They say 92% of the corn grown in the U.S. is GMO, okay? 94% of the soybeans and 94% of the cotton, okay? But yeah, it turns out that is popcorn a GMO? Good news is, if you're concerned about GMO, popcorn is a distinct type of corn from field and sweet corn and has not been genetically modified. Any kind of popcorn you buy that was grown in the U.S., organic or not, is non-GMO. Most of the popcorn eaten throughout the world is grown in the U.S. So maybe, you know, popcorn, yeah, maybe you got to diversify.
Hey, but that's our good news for the night. We're about to be done for the evening, guys. We appreciate everybody being here with you. And we got a brand new song debuting in just a couple moments. But Micah, why don't you wrap up here with this Ukraine story you got for us?
Yeah, and I want to do this fast, but I guess the main takeaway is that people in the United States military uniforms are going to be in Ukraine now. You knew it was only a matter of time. And we're not just talking about the Marines at the embassy. But yeah, it turns out that Friday, the Pentagon announced a $275 million, there's a lot of millions we've talked about on this show, a $275 million package of weapons aid to Ukraine. The 24th time it has tapped its inventories to aid Kiev through the basically presidential drawdown authority since August of 2021. So in a little bit more than a year, 12 months, they've tapped their inventory 24 times. The shipment includes high mobility artillery rocket systems, precision guided artillery rounds, remote anti-armor mine system, Humvees, and small arms. Oh yeah, that's what a region truly needs. The U.S. has spent $17.6 billion in security assistance, being the Lord of War. No, excuse me, since the start of the war, according to a Pentagon update on October 14th. So think about that, 17.6. That happens to be 10% of the student loan debt in this nation. $17.6 billion to Ukraine to aid in their war effort because, you know, we got to get involved in everybody's stuff everywhere, right? What is it, 100 and how many bases all over the world? So I guess they also say, and I'll just paraphrase it, these guys, they're not going to be at the front, so you don't got to worry about Junior dying or, you know, tie the ribbon around the tree and cry every day or nothing. These guys, they're just going to be making sure that all that weaponry that the U.S. sends to them gets in the right hands. They, you know, because I guess Russia said some of this stuff is showing up in, you know, underground fighters throughout the Middle East's hands and such. You know, kind of like the way we heard about the U.S. weapons going all over the world when they're supposed to go to certain places. So I guess they're going to put some inspectors there to make sure that they go to the right place.
Well, it's interesting because that program, if you're talking about the same one, I'm thinking of the Eric Holder under the Obama administration, gun walking. Yeah. That was the same, half of the same administration that's in power now, right? Because Biden was vice president during that administration. So interesting connection there. Guys, we appreciate you being with us tonight. I want to shout out the 18 or so people that were watching over here on Rockfin, and Jazzbo gave a $5 tip via Rockfin. Very much appreciate that. We got another dozen people watching over on Odyssey. Appreciate you guys as well. And then, of course, people watching here on Facebook and YouTube. You are all very much appreciated. It's been a fun show. We've got a lot of info. I'm going to make sure to get these links up on the website pretty much as soon as we wrap up, get this video posted, the archive. And you can find us on Spotify. Just search Live Free, Think Free. Go to thehoustonfreethinkers.com to see our previous shows. There's a lot happening to, you know, check out the news that maybe you're too busy to look up yourself and share some ideas with you, share some thoughts with you, see if you can get you thinking and finding solutions with all this craziness going on. Anything else you want to say, Micah, before we wrap up?
Food. Grow food. Just love yourself. Love your neighbor. Think about empowerment. Find ways to empower yourself because, you know, we're up against a lot of things. And, you know, trust your intuition and just be heart as much as you can because it is a short and a struggling life, but there's a lot of good stuff in the face of it. So we love you. We want you to be here as often as possible and join in and contribute in every way possible. We want to be here for you. So just, you know, give as much as you can to yourself and those you care about, and we'll see you next week.
Absolutely, guys. We're going to end with a brand new song from our friends So Below. I'm excited to hear this. Don't Ever Stray, So Below. If you got some, light it up. We'll see you next week.
kissing these girls, you know it come inside you. Gotta let it out, sometimes you gotta yell it out. Sometimes you flip off from the bass and drums and you gotta jump around. You gotta let go of the doubt, you can't let nothing hold you down. You have to realize what you are inside and I'm fleshing all about. You know that life is really cool and you might be feeling so below, but I need you to close your eyes and visualize the very best version of yourself. Cause you deserve to be yourself and you deserve to see the world.
Supposed to live on this planet. Don't let Babylon rotate you.